Truly means a lot. So thank you so much. Let's go ahead and begin. We're going to start in Galatians chapter 6. We're going to be reading verses 15 and 16 to establish the context for our lesson this morning. Galatians chapter 6, verses 15 and 16. Paul says here, "For neither is circumcision anything, nor uncircumcision, but a new creation. And those who will walk by this rule, peace and mercy be upon them and upon the Israel of God." There is a very interesting, if not curious, description of a group of people that Paul here mentions. He says the Israel of God in Galatians 6 verse 16. And the apostle says that the Israel of God, if they choose to walk according to God's rule, if they choose to walk according to God's law, they will become a new creation. They will be, in a sense, a transformed body of people. And once they've done this, then peace and mercy will be upon them. And it seems like the implication of this text is that if the Israel of God does not walk in conformity with God's moral standard, then it will be very difficult for them to enjoy a sense of peace in their lives. Now, there are a lot of debates by scholars about what or who specifically is this Israel of God. We're not going to get into this, you know, all the debates about it. I think it's pretty clear that he's simply talking about Christians. If you look back in chapter 5, verses 24 through 26 real quick, I think Paul gives enough evidence here for us to just accept the idea that the Israel of God is simply us Christians. He says in verse 24, "Now those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. If we live by the Spirit, let us also walk by the Spirit. Let us not become boastful, challenging one another, envying one another." Now, my interest this morning is not really about trying to find out who is the Israel of God, because we've said it is Christians. What I'm interested in this morning is for us to consider what constitutes the Israel of God. What kind of substance does this group of people is made up of? What kind of experience do they have that qualifies them to be called the Israel of God? What are the characteristics of their lives that somehow God says, if I see this in them, somehow then you become this Israel of God? So that's what I want to explore with you this morning. The what more than the who of the Israel of God. Let's begin with a definition of the word Israel itself. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 32. Genesis chapter 32, and I will be reading verse 28. Here, God talks to Jacob. And in verse 28, the text says this, God speaking. He says, "Your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." And as you notice here, the New American Standard Bible says, Jacob was striving with God. The New English Translation says, Jacob fought with God. The NIV says, Jacob was struggling with God. And based on this kind of struggling that was different from the struggling he's had before, God decided to change his name. Now, we just read the biblical definition of Israel means simply this: one who struggles with God, one who wrestles with God, one who fights with God, one who strives with God. But what does it really mean? Like, Why would this striving at this point in Jacob's life warrant a change of name? How should we understand this kind of fighting with God? I'm sure you parents would tell your kids fighting is really bad, right? I'm sure teachers would tell their students, do not fight, it's ugly. I'm sure the law enforcement officers would tell all of us, don't fight. So what in the world does it mean somehow that Jacob was fighting with God, fighting with men, and he prevailed, that God says, man, this is a turning point for you. And actually, it's a turning point in our relationship. Now, I think in order for us to really understand the what of this, we need to kind of go back and look deeper into Jacob's life and have a sense of understanding who in the world was this man and what brought him to this point that God made this powerful declaration and transformation, if you will, in his identity. Let's begin in Genesis chapter 25. Genesis chapter 25, and I will be reading verses 19 and following. Genesis 25, I begin in verse 19. The text says here, now these are the records of the generation of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban the Aramean, to be his wife. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. And the Lord answered him, and Rebekah his wife conceived. But the children struggled together within her. And she said, if it is so, why then am I this way? So she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples will be separated from your body. And one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. Verse 24 says, when her days to deliver were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now the first came forth red, all over like a hairy garment, and they named him Esau. Afterward, his brother came forth with his hand holding on to Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob, and Isaac was 60 years old when she gave birth to them. Now it says here that Jacob is one of twins. Alright, so when his mother was giving birth to them, his older brother came first, of course, but somehow, even before they were born, she felt this tension within her belly and was trying to figure out exactly, wonder what is going on here. And the text tells us, I'm not really sure in a practical, realistic way how that exactly happened, but it paints this picture that when Jacob came out, he was holding on to his brother's heel. And therefore they name him Jacob, the one who grabs the heel. And as we read consequently, as his story unfolds, if you will, we learn that actually that was just a way of life for Jacob. He always tried to one-up his brother. Can I just be real? When you look at Jacob, you could simply say he was nothing but a straight-up jerk. And it's interesting, actually, when you look in verse 27... it says, when the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter and a man of the field, but Jacob was a peaceful man living in the tent. You know, when you have those, especially if you are twins, I'm one of twins too. And the one who's always rambunctious and the one who's always kind of outdoorsy and rough and around the edge, he always gets in trouble. So the peaceful one actually is the one who creates the trouble. But the other one pays for it. See, here he says he was a peaceful man. Kind of like still water is really deep. That's exactly what's going on with this Jacob dude. He connived. He manipulated. He lied in order to get ahead. He wanted to be first in everything. Yes, you know, Esau was just whatever. Esau had his faults. He did not seize the opportunity of being the firstborn. I think he refused to take responsibility or the burden of being the firstborn. But one thing you cannot fault Esau for is that he was a skillful hunter and he loved to make his dad happy. He was crazy about Isaac. He was attached to his father. He would do whatever it takes to please his father. And his brother knew it. His brother knew it. It did not give Jacob any right, in a sense, because Esau was a little bit complacent about his responsibility, did not give him a right to take advantage of him. But that's exactly what he did. But you know what is worse about this story, the more we talk about it, is that Jacob was not alone. He had his mother on his side. I mean, he was his mother's favorite. He was his mother's little pet. He was mama's boy through and through. He knew, since she's the queen of the home, and since he's got her on his side, he can really, literally get away with anything he wants to. He knew that. And you understand what kind of advantage that gives a sibling over the other. But what is sad, actually, is that here the mother is paving a way for Jacob for the rest of his life, that you don't want, any time you want to get an advantage, you just grab somebody's heel and just pull them down. Anytime, actually, you're confronted with a situation, that's exactly the way you go about it. Jacob accepted this way of life. Now, the question that I've asked myself, maybe you have asked yourself as well, is this. How in the world did God choose such a dysfunctional family to represent His people? Have you ever asked yourself that question? I mean, let's read first, and then we'll go in a little bit in details about exactly how bad it was. In Genesis 25, verses 28 through 34, listen, a snapshot picture of what this family looked like. I begin in verse 28 of Genesis 25. It says, now Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. When Jacob had cooked stew, Esau came in from the field and he was famished. And Esau said to Jacob, please let me have a swallow of that red stuff there, for I am famished. Therefore his name was called Edom. But Jacob said, first sell me your birthright. Esau said, behold, I am about to die, so of what use then is the birthright to me? And Jacob said, first swear to me. So he swore to him and sold his brother his birthright. The end of the verse says, he ate and then he despised his birthright. That's not even the beginning of it, but we're going to get to it in a little bit. Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob, and Esau. Now, this is a family that God says through them, the rest of the world will be blessed. This is a family, actually, that came directly from the great Abraham. But yet, as we're going to be reading here, what we see is favoritism, preferential treatments in the home, unhealthy alliances between parents and children. We see conspiracies, we see backstabbing, we see lies and deception and manipulation and conniving. We see outbursts of anger, we see all kinds of bitterness and grudges, suspicions and pretensions. We see scandal, envy, jealousy, pain, anguish, hurt. We see all that kind of stuff that should not represent who Abraham's people is all about. But it's exactly who they were. Does that remind you of any modern family? Is any of that stuff reminds you of people you know, family you know? Or should I even say, does any of that stuff remind you of Christian's family that you know? Tensions, struggles, pretensions, conniving, pulling here and there. It is just appalling. The story does not stop here though. In chapter 27, we're not going to read all of it. But let me summarize. Let me just summarize. From even beginning in verse 1, it says that Isaac felt like, you know what? His time was coming to an end. So as any good father will do, he will call his sons or his children and give them, you know, the last blessings. Prepare them for after he's gone. He called his son Esau. He said, son, you know how tight you and I are. And you know how you can fix me them good games. The stuff that I really love. You could see Esau just licking his chops. How excited he was to go out there and get the biggest, the baddest game and come home, fix this incredible dinner for his father because he knew it pleased him. Because he knew he loved it. If that's the last thing he could do to his father, for his father, then that's what he was going to do with all that he had. And it's kind of like almost watching a soap opera. While all this was unfolding, this personal connection between Isaac and Esau, Rebecca was just peeking through the curtains and listening carefully to what was going on. And guess what she decided? It's my time to shine. I'm not sure if it was payback. I'm not sure what her ulterior motives were. It does not tell us, but I'm sure she had one. But the text tells us she quickly called her favorite son, Jacob, and he said, boy, you need to get here. Go outside and grab two goats from the flock. Bring it here. We're going to fix this wonderful dinner that your father likes. So you can have your brother's blessings. Now, automatically, Jacob is struck because he feels like, you know what? Let's see. I'm just real clean, don't have any hair on me. He's hairy. I'm lean and indoorsy and mama's boy. And he's burly and outdoorsy. And he's like, I'm going to be in trouble real quick. How in the world would I get away with this? And she says, you don't worry, I've got you covered. So he goes and grabs the goats, skin it, do whatever, fix it. And then the mother puts the goat skins on him. He says, dude, you need to be really good at pretending to be someone that you're not. Because that will give you blessings in life. It's a shortcut to really gaining much blessings that you don't really deserve. But let me just say you deserve because your mama said so. He's like, well, if you say so, mom, I will do it. And we hear almost that tension building because Isaac is here. He's like, okay, I'm confused because I hear the voice of Jacob, but then it seems like it's Esau's presence. Several times he asks, are you truly my son Esau? He says, yes, I am. He brought him closer to him. He smelled him. And then he's like, you know what? It cannot be but Esau. Maybe he was just trying to talk like his brother. So he blessed Jacob. All the blessing that should have gone to Esau came to Jacob. And then he says, the minute that Isaac had done blessing Jacob, guess who walks in? All excited. You could just see him beaming with excitement. Cannot wait, in a sense, to just see what his father had left for him. Esau barged in. He said, "Father, here you go. I've done exactly what you've asked me to do." And Isaac screams in bitterness, he says, violently shaking, wondering what just transpired here. And he told him, "Somebody came and pretended to be you, and I've blessed them already. It's impossible to undo what has already been done." And at the end of the text, chapter 27, it says that Esau had nothing but hatred for his brother. Verse 41. "So Esau bore a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, 'The days of mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob.'" Can you imagine? Can you imagine how dysfunctional that family was? Can you imagine how rotten and spoiled Jacob was? But yet God says, this is the family that's going to be the vessel of blessings for the rest of the world. How could this be? Now we learn, actually, as Rebekah heard that Esau is preparing to kill her favorite son, she told Jacob, "Hey, I want you to go to my family, run away. You don't have to deal with the mess that you've created. Run away. And after a while, maybe your brother will forget that he's got grudges against you. Then you can come back home." Isn't that convenient? He said, you don't have to clean that mess, actually. You don't have to confront your own reality. You don't have to confront your own shadow. He said, run away. But then Rebekah, she is slick. That lady was really slick. She went to Jacob, and guess what she said? "You know, if my son Jacob marries one of those women that Esau had married, I might as well just die. I can't take it anymore." Isn't that amazing? That's a mother. That's a wife who's doing this. So Isaac goes to Jacob and says, "You know what, son? My mother and I do not want to be miserable. If you marry one of the Canaanite women, if you marry one of the Hittite, please go to your family and find a wife there." She had him covered. I don't know. See, when you cheat, when you pretend, when you run away from the consequences of your actions, guess what life teaches you? That you will confront people who are better at cheating, who are better at pretending, and who are better at taking advantage of you. When you think you're running away, actually you're digging a deeper hole for your own self. You may be successful in the moment, but on the long term, it's a failing proposition. And guess what? As he's running towards his uncle Laban, and he's like, "Oh, poor little thing. Poor little thing. I'm going to take advantage of him," because Laban was so manipulative. He was trying to find an advantage from everything that moved in front of him. And for 20 years, Jacob was absolutely miserable. Because for the first time, he had a mirror in front of him that forced him to look at himself. This is how you've been all these years. You know what is interesting of this text? It says, Jacob said, enough is enough. 20 years he's been running away. He's lived in Haran with his uncle, married his uncle's two daughters, Rachel and Leah. Interesting, actually. He was trying to beat the system, right? By marrying the younger sister. And guess what Laban did? He says, "We don't do it that way here. You're going to be stuck with the firstborn." You see the motive here? You may have beaten your brother in getting his blessings, You're not going to get away with this here. He would do it right. The firstborn marries first. And if you're trying to cheat and have Rachel, you're going to be stuck with Leah. I don't care how beautiful she is. I don't care how bad Leah's eyes are. You're going to be stuck with her. Over and over and over again, Jacob was confronted with his own shadow, in a sense, with his own struggles. And the text tells us that he finally decided to go back home and clean his mess up, because he was tired of trying to one-up somebody else to get ahead in life. That was not the way. It was not a successful formula in life. And what is interesting to me, actually, is all along, God has just been a very nice convenience for Jacob. Remember when his father asked him, in chapter 27, verse 20, how did you get back so fast? Because I know it takes a while to go and hunt for a game and clean it and fix dinner and all that. How did you get back so quickly? Listen to his response. Chapter 27, verse 20. Isaac said to his son, how is it that you have so quickly have it, my son? And he said, because the Lord your God caused it to happen to me. God is so good, he said. See, all this time, even though he was living in the presence of God, he never had a hold of who God was. He just used God as a convenience for his own benefit. Finally, he said, enough is enough. My ways are catching up with me. I cannot run anymore. I cannot pretend anymore. I cannot hide anymore. So in Genesis chapter 32, Jacob is making his way back home. In Genesis 22, Jacob is making his way back home. And guess who Jacob is worried about? 20 years later. Guess what's consuming his mind? Guess what he's flooded with? His brother Esau. Now, this is a man who's been very successful. This is a man who have 11 kids, 2 wives and 2 concubines. This is a man who's done so great being away. But 20 years, he's been bothered with what he's done. He could not run anymore. Listen to what verse, let me see what verse that is. Verse 7 says, then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, chapter 32, and he divided the people who were with him and the flocks and herds in 2 companies. Verse 11 of chapter 32, he prays to God, and this is what he tells God. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him that he will come and attack me and the mothers with the children. So as he's making his way closer to home, closer to his brother, the text tells us in verse 24, Jacob came to a river. I think the river is almost symbolic. The Jabbok River. Actually, the word Jabbok means twisted river. In a sense, symbolic for the twisting, the winding and the twisting of life. He had come at this juncture where something had to change. And what he did for the first time, he took his family, he took his possession, he took everything he had and put them on the other side. Jacob says, I've got to do this alone. Somehow, God, I have to confront him alone. I have to come to terms with him alone. I don't need my mother. I don't need my uncle. I don't need anybody else. I need to reconcile the idea of God in my faith, in my reality, alone. So he went along, and he says in verse 24, While he was there, he met a man, and Jacob was wrestling with that man all night long, and dawn was breaking. He would not let go. Verse 25 says, reading verse 24. Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh. So the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for the dawn is breaking." But he said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." He says, "Surely you shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with men. Now, finally, you have prevailed." He finally got hold of God himself. And he was wrestling with God. Finally, he felt, this is how I get blessings in life. And I will not let go of him, no matter how much I'm struggling. You know what's interesting with this statement? I think this is why God used Jacob. Because he represents who you and I are. Throughout life, as Christians, we're constantly going to be wrestling with stuff. Walking with a limp, whatever it is, anger and immorality and drinking and cussing and faithlessness and doubting, whatever our struggles are. He's going to pain us. But if you just hold on to God, you know somehow there's going to be a transformation that's going to be happening to you. No longer should you try to grab everybody's heel, trip them up in order for you to just get ahead. Just hold on to God is enough. And not let go of him. That is why God used Jacob's story to represent the Israel of God, what you and I are and should be. It's so powerful. A change of name is essentially a change of character, a change of purpose, a change of priority. If you look in Hosea chapter 12, I love the summary he gives here about the transformation that Jacob went through in Hosea chapter 12. Let's read verses 2-6. Hosea 12, real quick, as we draw a conclusion slowly here. Hosea 12, I start in verse 2. It says, "The Lord also has a dispute with Judah, and will punish Jacob according to his ways. He will repay him according to his deeds. In the womb, Jacob took his brother by heel. But in his maturity, he contended with God. Yes, he wrestled with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor. He found him at Bethel, and there he spoke with us. Even the Lord, the God of hosts, the Lord is his name. Therefore, return to your God. Observe kindness and justice and wait for your God continually." Oftentimes, when people think of Christianity and Christians, we kind of think of Christians or the church should be like a museum. I don't know if you've been to a museum, but if you walk into a museum, you've got all those great masterpieces. And everybody walks with a specific gait and a specific posture. You kind of talk whispering under your breath. You kind of just, you know what I'm saying? There's this reverence that you give. There's this almost rigidness. There's this looking the part kind of thing that you do. And the curator will be there going over all the great pieces and give the history of all of them. Oftentimes, that's how we treat the church.
But in reality, you know what the Israel of God really looks like? It looks like a hospital where you got sick people dying to feel better. Of course, you've got your area where you've got newborns, right? Everybody's celebrating. But you also have your NICU where the newborns are on a lifeline. You got your emergency room where doctors are going back and forth because there's crisis over crisis over crisis. But every single one of those patients, they're dying to live. That's what the church really looks like. And the dysfunctionality of that family that God says is going to be a vessel for blessing was chosen for a specific reason. It represents us. So to be the Israel of God means we are constantly in this wrestling match between good and evil, between the angel and our inner demons, between right and wrong, between sin and righteousness. That's what the church is. And when God saw that Jacob finally understood this, he changed his name to Israel. And Paul calls Christians the Israel of God. There may be someone this morning here who has not given his life or her life to Christ yet, because you constantly overwhelm with your own shadows, your own struggles, and feel so undeserving of becoming a Christian. And you know what God says this morning to you? You're a perfect candidate to be the Israel of God. There may be Christians here, actually, who for months, if not years, been trying to prepare themselves to walk forward and confess their sins. They're so afraid that their lives don't look like all the masterpieces in these wonderful museums over there. But you know what God is saying this morning? The museum is just a pretension. The hospital is the reality. If you come forward now and confess, you'll be right at home, wrestling while you're holding on to who God is and never let go. Whatever your need is, please come forward as we stand and sing.
When the trumpet of the Lord has sounded, the time shall be no more, and the Lord of grace eternal, bright and fair. When the saints of earth shall gather over on the other shore, and the rollers fall of yonder, I'll be there.
When the roll is all of yonder, I'll be there. When the roll is all of yonder, I'll be there. When the roll is all of yonder, I'll be there. But you can't wait till tonight, can you? Jimmy, cover your ears a minute. I've told people many times, I don't know if anybody, any preacher I know, has more ability to communicate and work with people than Jimmy. And I've seen that in the Seychelles. I've seen it when he's been here. And I think you see the ability of this man to communicate.